He brought the mallet down again, and this time she rolled toward him, down the stairs, inside the arc of his swing. A shriek escaped her as her broken ribs thumped and grated. She struck his shins with her body while he was off balance, and he fell backward with a yell of anger and surprise, his feet jigging to keep their purchase on the stair riser. Then he thumped to the floor, the mallet flying from his hand. He sat up, staring at her for a moment with shocked eyes.
"I'll kill you for that," he said.
He rolled over and stretched out for the handle of the mallet. Wendy forced herself to her feet. Her left leg sent bolt after bolt of pain all the way up to her hip. Her face was ashy pale, but set. She leaped onto his back as his hand closed over the shaft of the roque mallet.
"Oh, dear God!"
she screamed to the overlook shadowy lobby, and buried the kitchen knife in his lower back up to the handle. He stiffened beneath her, and then shrieked. She thought she had never heard such an awful sound in her whole life. It was as if the very boards and windows and doors of the hotel had screamed. It seemed to go on and on while he remained bored stiff beneath her weight. They were like a parlor charade of horse and rider, except that the back of his red and black checked flannel shirt was growing darker, sodden with spreading blood. Then he collapsed forward on his face, bucking her off on her hurt side, making her groan. She lay breathing harshly for a time, unable to move. She was an excruciating throb of pain from one end to the other. Every time she inhaled, something stabbed viciously at her, and her neck was wet with blood from her grazed ear. There was only the sound of her struggle to breathe, the wind, and the ticking clock in the ballroom. At last she forced herself to her feet and hobbled across to the stairway. When she got there, she clung to the newel post, head down, waves of faintness washing over her. When it had passed a little, she began to climb, using her unhurt leg and pulling with her arms on the banister. Once she looked up, expecting to see Danny there, but the stairway was empty.
"Thank God he slept through it. Thank God, thank God."
6 steps up she had to rest, her head down, her blonde hair coiled on and over the banister. Air whistled painfully through her throat, as if it had grown barbs. Her right side was a swollen, hot mass.
"Come on, Wendy. Come on, old girl. Get a locked door behind you, and then look at the damage. 13 more to go, not so bad. And when you get to the upstairs corridor, you can crawl. I give my permission."
She drew in as much breath as her broken ribs would allow, and half pulled, half fell up another riser, and another. She was on the 9th, almost halfway up, when Jack's voice came from behind and below her. He said thickly,
"You bitch! You killed me!"
Terror as black as midnight swept through her. She looked over her shoulder and saw Jack getting slowly to his feet. His back was bowed over, and she could see the handle of the kitchen knife sticking out of it. His eyes seemed to have contracted, almost to have lost themselves in the pale, sagging folds of the skin around them. He was grasping the roque mallet loosely in his left hand. The end of it was bloody. A scrap of her pink terrycloth robe stuck almost in the center.
"I'll give you your medicine,"
he whispered, and began to stagger toward the stairs. Whimpering with fear, she began to pull herself upward again. 10 steps, a dozen, a baker's dozen. But still the first floor hallway looked as far above her as an unattainable mountain peak. She was panting now, her side shrieking in protest. Her hair swung wildly back and forth in front of her face. Sweat stung her eyes. The ticking of the domed clock in the ballroom seemed to fill her ears, and counterpointing it, Jack's panting, agonized gasps as he began to mount the stairs. 51. Halloran arrives. Larry Durkin was a tall and skinny man with a morose face overtopped with a luxuriant mane of red hair. Halloran had caught him just as he was leaving the Conoco station, the morose face buried deeply inside an army-issue parka. He was reluctant to do any more business that stormy day, no matter how far Halloran had come, and even more reluctant to rent one of his 2 snowmobiles out to this wild-eyed black man who insisted on going up to the old Overlook. Among people who had spent most of their lives in the little town of Sidewinder, The hotel had a smelly reputation. Murder had been done up there. A bunch of hoods had run the place for a while, and cutthroat businessmen had run it for a while, too. And things had been done up at the old Overlook that never made the papers, because money has a way of talking. But the people in Sidewinder had a pretty good idea. Most of the hotel's chambermaids came from here, and chambermaids see a lot. But when Halloran mentioned Howard Cottrell's name and showed Durkin the tag inside one of the blue mittens, the gas station owner thawed.
"Sent you here, did he?"
Durkin asked, unlocking one of the garage bays and leading Halloran inside.
"Good to know the old rip's got some sense left. I thought he was plumb out of it."
He flicked a switch, and a bank of very old and very dirty fluorescents buzzed wearily into life.
"Now what in the tarnal creation would you want up at that place, fella?"
Halloran's nerve had begun to crack. The last few miles into Sidewinder had been very bad. Once a gust of wind that must have been tooling along at better than 60 miles an hour had floated the Buick all the way around in a 360-degree turn. And there were still miles to travel, with God alone knew what at the other end of them. He was terrified for the boy. Now it was almost 7:10, and he had this whole song and dance to go through again.
"Somebody is in trouble up there," he said very carefully. "The son of the caretaker."
"Who? Torrance's boy? Now what kind of trouble could he be in?"
"I don't know," Halloran muttered. He felt sick with the time this was taking. He was speaking with a countryman, and he knew that all countrymen feel a similar need to approach their business obliquely, to smell around its corners and sides before plunging into the middle of dealing. But there was no time, because now he was one scared nigger, and if this went on much longer, he just might decide to cut and run.
"Look," he said, "please, I need to go up there, and I have to have a snowmobile to get there. I'll pay you price, but for God's sake, let me get on with my business."
"All right," Durkin said, unperturbed. "If Howard sent you, that's good enough. You take this Arctic Cat. I'll put 5 gallons of gas in the can. Tank's full. She'll get you up and back down, I guess."
"Thank you,"
Halloran said, not quite steadily.
"I'll take $20. That includes the Ethel."
Halloran fumbled a 20 out of his wallet and handed it over. Durkin tucked it into one of his shirt pockets with hardly a look.
"Guess maybe we better trade jackets, too," Durkin said, pulling off his parka. "That overcoat of yours ain't gonna be worth nothing tonight. You trade me back when you return the snow sled."
"Oh, hey, I couldn't—"
"Don't fuss with me," Durkin interrupted, still mildly. "I ain't sending you out to freeze. I only gotta walk down 2 blocks and I'm at my own supper table. Give it over."
Slightly dazed, Halloran traded his overcoat for Durkin's fur-lined parka. Overhead, the fluorescence buzzed faintly, reminding him of the lights in the Overlook's kitchen.
"Torrance's boy," Durkin said and shook his head. "Good-looking little tyke, ain't he? He and his dad was in here a lot before the snow really flew, driving the hotel truck mostly. Looked to me like the two of them was just about as tight as they could get. That's one little boy that loves his daddy. Hope he's all right."
"So do I."
Halloran zipped the parka and tied the hood.
"Let me help you push that out," Durkin said.
They rolled the snowmobile across the oil-stained concrete and toward the garage bay.
"You ever drove one of these before?"
"No."
"Well, there's nothing to it. The instructions are pasted there on the dashboard, but all there really is stop and go. Your throttle's here, just like a motorcycle throttle. Brake on the other side, lean with it on the turns. This baby will do 70 on hard pack, but on this powder, you'll get no more than 50, and that's pushing it."
Now they were in the service station's snow-filled front lot, and Durkin had raised his voice to make himself heard over the battering of the wind.
"Stay on the road," he shouted at Halloran's ear. "Keep your eye on the guardrail posts and the signs, and you'll be all right, I guess. If you get off the road, you're gonna be dead. Understand?"
Halloran nodded.
"Wait a minute,"
Durkin told him, and ran back into the garage bay. While he was gone, Halloran turned the key in the ignition and pumped the throttle a little. The snowmobile coughed into brash, choppy life. Durkin came back with a red and black ski mask.
"Put this on under your hood," he shouted.
Halloran dragged it on. It was a tight fit, but it cut the last of the numbing wind off from his cheeks and forehead and chin. Durkin leaned close to make himself heard.
I guess you must know about things the same way Howie does sometimes, he said. It don't matter, except that place has got a bad reputation around here. I'll give you a rifle if you want it.
I don't think it would do any good,
Halloran shouted back. You're the boss, but if you get that boy, you bring him to 16 Peach Lane. The wife will have some soup on.
Okay, thanks for everything.
You watch out, Durkin yelled. Stay on the road.
Halloran nodded and twisted the throttle slowly. The snowmobile purred forward, the headlamp cutting a clean cone of light through the thickly falling snow. He saw Durkin's upraised hand in the rearview mirror and raised his own in return. Then he nudged the handlebars to the left and was traveling up Main Street, the snowmobile coursing smoothly through the white light thrown by the street lamps. The speedometer stood at 30 miles an hour. It was 7:10. At the Overlook, Wendy and Danny were sleeping, and Jack Torrance was discussing matters of life and death with the previous caretaker. 5 blocks up Main, the street lamps ended. For 0.5 mile there were small houses, all buttoned tightly up against the storm, and then only wind-howling darkness. In the black again, with no light but the thin spear of the snowmobile's headlamp, terror closed in on him again, a childlike fear, dismal and disheartening. He had never felt so alone. For several minutes, as the few lights of Sidewinder dwindled away and disappeared in the rear view, the urge to turn around and go back was almost insurmountable. He reflected that for all of Durkin's concern for Jack Torrance's boy, he had not offered to take the other snowmobile and come with him.
That place has got a bad reputation around here.
Clenching his teeth, he turned the throttle higher and watched the needle on the speedometer climb past 40 and settle at 45. He seemed to be going horribly fast, and yet he was afraid it wasn't fast enough. At this speed, it would take him almost an hour to get to the Overlook, but at a higher speed, he might not get there at all. He kept his eyes glued to the passing guardrails and the dime-sized reflectors mounted on top of each one. Many of them were buried under drifts. Twice he saw curve signs dangerously late and felt the snowmobile riding up the drifts that masked the drop-off before turning back onto where the road was in the summertime. The odometer counted off the miles at a maddeningly slow clip. 5, 10, finally 15. Even behind the knitted ski mask, his face was beginning to stiffen up, and his legs were growing numb.
Guess I'd give $100 for a pair of ski pants.
As each mile turned over, his terror grew, as if the place had a poison atmosphere that thickened as you neared it. Had it ever been like this before? He had never really liked the Overlook, and there had been others who shared his feeling, but it had never been like this. He could feel the voice that had almost wrecked him outside of Sidewinder, still trying to get in, to get past his defenses to the soft meat inside. If it had been strong 25 miles back, how much stronger would it be now? He couldn't keep it out entirely. Some of it was slipping through, flooding his brain with sinister subliminal images. More and more, he got the image of a badly hurt woman in a bathroom, holding her hands up uselessly to ward off a blow. And he felt more and more that the woman must be,
Jesus, watch out!
The embankment was looming up ahead of him like a freight train. Wool gathering, he had missed a turn sign. He jerked the snowmobile steering gear hard right, and it swung around, tilting as it did so. From underneath came the harsh, grating sound of the snow tread on rock. He thought the snowmobile was going to dump him, and it did totter on the knife edge of balance before half-driving, half-skidding back down to the more or less level surface of the snow-buried road. Then the drop-off was ahead of him, the headlamp showing an abrupt end to the snow cover, and darkness beyond that. He turned the snowmobile the other way, a pulse beating sickly in his throat.
Keep it on the road, Dickie, old chum.
He forced himself to turn the throttle up another notch. Now the speedometer needle was pegged just below 50. The wind howled and roared. The headlamp probed the dark. An unknown length of time later, he came around a drift-banked curve and saw a glimmering flash of light ahead. Just a glimpse, and then it was blotted out by a rising fold of land. The glimpse was so brief he was persuading himself it had been wishful thinking, when another turn brought it into view again, slightly closer, for another few seconds. There was no question of its reality this time. He had seen it from just this angle too many times before. It was the Overlook. There were lights on the first floor and lobby levels, it looked like. Some of his terror, the part that had to do with driving off the road or wrecking the snowmobile on an unseen curve, melted entirely away. The snowmobile swept surely into the first half of an S-curve that he now remembered confidently foot for foot, and that was when the headlamp picked out the, oh dear Jesus God, what is it, in the road ahead of him. Limned in stark blacks and whites, Halloran first thought it was some hideously huge timber wolf that had been driven down from the high country by the storm. Then, as he closed on it, he recognized it, and horror closed his throat. Not a wolf, but a lion. A hedge lion. Its features were a mask of black shadow and powdered snow, its haunches wound tight to spring. And it did spring, snow billowing around its pistoning rear legs in a silent burst of crystal glitter. Halloran screamed and twisted the handlebars hard right, ducking low at the same time. Scratching, ripping pain scrawled itself across his face, his neck, his shoulders. The ski mask was torn open down the back. He was hurled from the snowmobile. He hit the snow, plowed through it, rolled over. He could feel it coming for him. In his nostrils there was a bitter smell of green leaves and holly. A huge hedge paw batted him in the small of the back, and he flew 10 feet through the air, splayed out like a rag doll. He saw the snowmobile, riderless, strike the embankment and rear up, its headlamp searching the sky. It fell over with a thump and stalled. Then the hedge lion was on him. There was a crackling, rustling sound. Something raked across the front of the parka, shredding it. It might have been stiff twigs, but Halloran knew it was claws. "You're not there!" Halloran screamed at the circling, snarling hedge lion. "You're not there at all!" He struggled to his feet and made it halfway to the snowmobile before the lion lunged, batting him across the head with a needle-tipped paw. Halloran saw silent, exploding lights. "Not there," he said again, but it was a fading mutter. His knees unhinged and dropped him into the snow. He crawled for the snowmobile, the right side of his face a scarf of blood. The lion struck him again, rolling him onto his back like a turtle. It roared playfully. Halloran struggled to reach the snowmobile. What he needed was there. And then the lion was on him again, ripping and clawing. 52. Wendy and Jack. Wendy risked another glance over her shoulder. Jack was on the 6th riser, clinging to the banister much as she was doing herself. He was still grinning, and dark blood oozed slowly through the grin and slipped down the line of his jaw. He bared his teeth at her.
"I'm gonna bash your brains in. Bash them right to fuck in."
He struggled up another riser. Panic spurred her, and the ache in her side diminished a little. She pulled herself up as fast as she could, regardless of the pain, yanking convulsively at the banister. She reached the top and threw a glance behind her. He seemed to be gaining strength rather than losing it. He was only 4 risers from the top, measuring the distance with the roque mallet in his left hand as he pulled himself up with his right.
"Right behind you,"
he panted through his bloody grin, as if reading her mind.
"Right behind you now, bitch. With your medicine."
She fled stumblingly down the main corridor, hands pressed to her side. The door to one of the rooms jerked open, and a man with a green ghoul mask on popped out.
"Great party, isn't it?"
He screamed into her face and pulled the waxed string of a party favor. There was an echoing bang, and suddenly crepe streamers were drifting all around her. The man in the ghoul mask cackled and slammed back into his room. She fell forward onto the carpet, full length. Her right side seemed to explode with pain, and she fought off the blackness of unconsciousness desperately. Dimly she could hear the elevator running again, and beneath her splayed fingers she could see that the carpet pattern appeared to move, swaying and twining sinuously. The mallet slammed down behind her, and she threw herself forward, sobbing. Over her shoulder she saw Jack stumble forward, overbalance, and bring the mallet down just before he crashed to the carpet, expelling a bright splash of blood onto the nap. The mallet head struck her squarely between the shoulder blades, and for a moment the agony was so great that she could only writhe, hands opening and clenching. Something inside her had snapped. She had heard it clearly, and for a few moments she was aware only in a muted, muffled way, as if she were merely observing these things through a cloudy wrapping of gauze. Then full consciousness came back, terror and pain with it. Jack was trying to get up so he could finish the job. Wendy tried to stand and found it was impossible. Electric bolts seemed to course up and down her back at the effort. She began to crawl along in a side-stroke motion. Jack was crawling after her, using the roque mallet as a crutch or a cane. She reached the corner and pulled herself around it, using her hands to yank at the angle of the wall. Her terror deepened. She would not have believed that possible, but it was. It was 100 times worse not to be able to see him or know how close he was getting. She tore out fistfuls of the carpet napping, pulling herself along, and she was halfway down this short hall before she noticed the bedroom door was standing wide open.
Danny! Oh, Jesus!
She forced herself to her knees and then clawed her way to her feet, fingers slipping over the silk wallpaper. Her nails pulled little strips of it loose. She ignored the pain and half-walked, half-shambled through the doorway as Jack came around the far corner and began to lunge his way down toward the open door, leaning on the roque mallet. She caught the edge of the dresser, held herself up against it, and grabbed the doorframe. Jack shouted at her,
"Don't you shut that door! God damn you! Don't you dare shut it!"
She slammed it closed and shot the bolt. Her left hand pawed wildly at the junk on the dresser, knocking loose coins onto the floor where they rolled in every direction. Her hand seized the key ring just as the mallet whistled down against the door, making it tremble in its frame. She got the key into the lock on the second stab and twisted it to the right. At the sound of the tumblers falling, Jack screamed. The mallet came down against the door in a volley of booming blows that made her flinch and step back. How could he be doing that with a knife in his back? Where was he finding the strength? She wanted to shriek, "Why aren't you dead?" at the locked door. Instead, she turned around. She and Danny would have to go into the attached bathroom and lock that door, too, in case Jack actually could break through the bedroom door. The thought of escaping down the dumbwaiter shaft crossed her mind in a wild burst, and then she rejected it. Danny was small enough to fit into it, but she would be unable to control the rope pull. He might go crashing all the way to the bottom. The bathroom it would have to be. And if Jack broke through into there. But she wouldn't allow herself to think of it.
"Danny, honey, you'll have to wake up and—"
But the bed was empty. When he had begun to sleep more soundly, she had thrown the blankets and one of the quilts over him. Now they were thrown back.
"I'll get you!"
Jack howled.
"I'll get both of you!"
Every other word was punctuated with a blow from the roque hammer, yet Wendy ignored both. All of her attention was focused on that empty bed.
"Come out here! Unlock this goddamn door!"
"Danny?"
she whispered. Of course, when Jack had attacked her, it had come through to him, as violent emotions always seem to. Perhaps he'd even seen the whole thing in a nightmare. He was hiding. She fell clumsily to her knees, enduring another bolt of pain from her swollen and bleeding leg, and looked under the bed. Nothing there but dust balls and Jack's bedroom slippers. Jack screamed her name, and this time when he swung the mallet, a long splinter of wood jumped from the door and clattered off the hardwood planking. The next blow brought a sickening, splintering crack, the sound of dry kindling under a hatchet. The bloody mallet head, now splintered and gouged in its own right, bashed through the new hole in the door, was withdrawn, and came down again, sending wooden shrapnel flying across the room. Wendy pulled herself to her feet again using the foot of the bed and hobbled across the room to the closet. Her broken ribs stabbed at her, making her groan.
"Danny?"
She brushed the hung garments aside frantically. Some of them slipped their hangers and ballooned gracelessly to the floor. He was not in the closet. She hobbled toward the bathroom, and as she reached the door she glanced back over her shoulder. The mallet crashed through again, widening the hole, and then a hand appeared, groping for the bolt. She saw with horror that she had left Jack's key ring dangling from the lock. The hand yanked the bolt back, and as it did so, it struck the bunched keys. They jingled merrily. The hand clutched them victoriously. With a sob, she pushed her way into the bathroom and slammed the door just as the bedroom door burst open and Jack charged through, bellowing. Wendy ran the bolt and twisted the spring lock, looking around desperately. The bathroom was empty. Danny wasn't here either. And as she caught sight of her own blood-smeared, horrified face in the medicine cabinet mirror, she was glad. She had never believed that children should be witness to the little quarrels of their parents. And perhaps the thing that was now raving through the bedroom, overturning things and smashing them, would finally collapse before it could go after her son. Perhaps, she thought, it might be possible for her to inflict even more damage on it. Kill it, perhaps. Her eyes skated quickly over the bathroom's machine-produced porcelain surfaces, looking for anything that might serve as a weapon. There was a bar of soap, but even wrapped in a towel she didn't think it would be lethal enough. Everything else was bolted down. God, was there nothing she could do? Beyond the door, the animal sounds of destruction went on and on, accompanied by thick shouts that they would take their medicine and pay for what they'd done to him. He would show them who's boss. They were worthless puppies, the both of them. There was a thump as her record player was overturned, a hollow crash as the second-hand TV's picture tube was smashed, the tinkle of window glass followed by a cold draft under the bathroom door. A dull thud as the mattresses were ripped from the twin beds where they had slept together, hip to hip. Boomings as Jack struck the walls indiscriminately with the mallet. There was nothing of the real Jack in that howling, maundering, petulant voice, though. It alternately whined in tones of self-pity and rose in lurid screams. It reminded her chillingly of the screams that sometimes rose in the geriatrics ward of the hospital where she had worked summers as a high school kid. Senile dementia. Jack wasn't out there anymore. She was hearing the lunatic, raving voice of the Overlook itself. The mallet smashed into the bathroom door, knocking out a huge chunk of the thin paneling. Half of a crazed and working face stared in at her. The mouth and cheeks and throat were lathered in blood. The single eye she could see was tiny and piggish and glittering.
"Nowhere left to run, you cunt!"
It panted at her through its grin. The mallet descended again, knocking wood splinters into the tub and against the reflecting surface of the medicine cabinet.
The medicine cabinet!
A desperate whining noise began to escape her as she whirled, pain temporarily forgotten, and threw the mirror door of the cabinet back. She began to paw through its contents. Behind her, that hoarse voice bellowed,
"Here I come now! Here I come now, you pig!"
It was demolishing the door in a machine-like frenzy. Bottles and jars fell before her madly searching fingers. Cough syrup, Vaseline, Clairol herbal essence shampoo, hydrogen peroxide, benzocaine, they fell into the sink and shattered. Her hand closed over the dispenser of double-edged razor blades, just as she heard the hand again, fumbling for the bolt and the spring lock. She slipped one of the razor blades out, fumbling at it, her breath coming in harsh little gasps. She had cut the ball of her thumb. She whirled around and slashed at the hand, which had turned the lock and was now fumbling for the bolt. Jack screamed. The hand was jerked back. Panting, holding the razor blade between her thumb and index finger, she waited for him to try again. He did, and she slashed. He screamed again, trying to grab her hand, and she slashed at him again. The razor blade turned in her hand, cutting her again, and dropped to the tile floor by the toilet. Wendy slipped another blade out of the dispenser and waited. Movement in the other room.
Going away?
And a sound coming through the bedroom window. A motor. A high, insectile buzzing sound. A roar of anger from Jack, and then, yes. Yes, she was sure of it. He was leaving the caretaker's apartment, plowing through the wreckage and out into the hall.
"Someone coming? A ranger? Dick Halloran? Oh, God!"
she muttered brokenly through a mouth that seemed filled with broken sticks and old sawdust.
"Oh, God! Oh, please!"
She had to leave now, had to go find her son so they could face the rest of this nightmare side by side. She reached out and fumbled at the bolt. Her arms seemed to stretch for miles. At last she got it to come free. She pushed the door open, staggered out, and was suddenly overcome by the horrible certainty that Jack had only pretended to leave, that he was lying in wait for her. Wendy looked around. The room was empty, the living room too. Jumbled, broken stuff everywhere. The closet? Empty. Then the soft shades of gray began to wash over her, and she fell down on the mattress Jack had ripped from the bed, semi-conscious. 53. Halloran laid low. Halloran reached the overturned snowmobile just as, a mile and a half away, Wendy was pulling herself around the corner and into the short hallway leading to the caretaker's apartment. It wasn't the snowmobile he wanted, but the gas can, held on to the back by a pair of elastic straps. His hands, still clad in Howard Cottrell's blue mittens, seized the top strap and pulled it free as the hedge lion roared behind him, a sound that seemed to be more in his head than outside of it. A hard, brambly slap to his left leg, making the knee sing with pain as it was driven in a way the joint had never been expected to bend. A groan escaped Halloran's clenched teeth. It would come for the kill any time now, tired of playing with him. He fumbled for the second strap. Sticky blood ran in his eyes.
Roar! Slap!
That one raked across his buttocks, almost tumbling him over and away from the snowmobile again. He held on, no exaggeration, for dear life. Then he had freed the second strap. He clutched the gas can to him as the lion struck again, rolling him over on his back. He saw it again, only a shadow in the darkness and falling snow, as nightmarish as a moving gargoyle. Halloran twisted at the can's cap as the moving shadow stalked him, kicking up snow puffs. As it moved in again, the cap spun free, releasing the pungent smell of the gasoline. Halloran gained his knees, and as it came at him, low-slung and incredibly quick, he splashed it with the gas. There was a hissing, spitting sound, and it drew back.
"Gas!"
Halloran cried, his voice shrill and breaking.
"Gonna burn you, baby! Dig on it a while!"
The lion came at him again, still spitting angrily. Halloran splashed it again, but this time the lion didn't give. It charged ahead. Halloran sensed rather than saw its head angling at his face, and he threw himself backward, partially avoiding it. Yet the lion still hit his upper ribcage a glancing blow, and a flare of pain struck there. Gas gurgled out of the can which he still held, and doused his right hand and arm, cold as death. Now he lay on his back in a snow angel, to the right of the snowmobile by about 10 paces. The hissing lion was a bulking presence to his left, closing in again. Halloran thought he could see its tail twitching. He yanked Cottrell's mitten off his right hand, tasting sodden wool and gasoline. He ripped up the hem of the parka and jammed his hand into his pants pocket. Down in there, along with his keys and his change, was a very battered old Zippo lighter. He had bought it in Germany in 1954. Once the hinge had broken, and he had returned it to the Zippo factory, and they had repaired it without charge, just as advertised. A nightmare flood of thoughts flooding through his mind in a split second. "Dear Zippo, my lighter was swallowed by a crocodile, dropped from an airplane, lost in the Pacific Trench, saved me from a kraut bullet in the Battle of the Bulge. Dear Zippo, if this fucker doesn't go, that lion is going to rip my head off." The lighter was out. He clicked the hood back. The lion, rushing at him, a growl like ripping cloth, his finger flicking the striker wheel, spark, flame, my hand. His gasoline-soaked hand, suddenly ablaze, the flames running up the sleeve of the parka, no pain, no pain yet, the lion shying from the torch, suddenly blazing in front of it, a hideous, flickering hedge sculpture with eyes and a mouth, shying away, too late. Wincing at the pain, Halloran drove his blazing arm into its stiff and scratchy side. In an instant, the whole creature was in flames, a prancing, writhing pyre on the snow. It bellowed in rage and pain, seeming to chase its flaming tail as it zigzagged away from Halloran. He thrust his own arm deep into the snow, killing the flames, unable to take his eyes from the hedge lion's death agonies for a moment. Then, gasping, he got to his feet. The arm of Durkin's parka was sooty but unburned, and that also described his hand. 30 yards downhill from where he stood, the hedge lion had turned into a fireball. Sparks flew at the sky and were viciously snatched away by the wind. For a moment its ribs and skull were etched in orange flame, and then it seemed to collapse, disintegrate, and fall into separate, burning piles.
Never mind it. Get moving.
He picked up the gas can and struggled over to the snowmobile. His consciousness seemed to be flickering in and out, offering him cuttings and snippets of home movies, but never the whole picture. In one of these, he was aware of yanking the snowmobile back onto its tread and then sitting on it, out of breath and incapable of moving for a few moments. In another, he was reattaching the gas can, which was still half full. His head was thumping horribly from the gas fumes, and in reaction to his battle with the hedge lion, he supposed, and he saw by the steaming hole in the snow beside him that he had vomited, but he was unable to remember when. The snowmobile, the engine still warm, fired immediately. He twisted the throttle unevenly and started forward with a series of neck-snapping jerks that made his head ache even more fiercely. At first the snowmobile wove drunkenly from side to side, but by half-standing to get his face above the windscreen and into the sharp, needling blast of the wind, he drove some of the stupor out of himself. He opened the throttle wider.
Where are the rest of the hedge animals?
He didn't know, but at least he wouldn't be caught unaware again. The overlook loomed in front of him, the lighted first-floor windows throwing long yellow rectangles onto the snow. The gate at the foot of the drive was locked, and he dismounted after a wary look around, praying he hadn't lost his keys when he pulled his lighter out of his pocket. No, they were there. He picked through them in the bright light thrown by the snowmobile headlamp. He found the right one and unsnapped the padlock, letting it drop into the snow. At first, he didn't think he was going to be able to move the gate anyway. He pawed frantically at the snow surrounding it, disregarding the throbbing agony in his head and the fear that one of the other lions might be creeping up behind him. He managed to pull it a foot and a half away from the gatepost, squeezed into the gap, and pushed. He got it to move another 2 feet, enough room for the snowmobile, and threaded it through. He became aware of movement ahead of him in the dark. The hedge animals, all of them, were clustered at the base of the overlook's steps, guarding the way in, the way out. The lions prowled. The dog stood with its front paws on the first step. Halloran opened the throttle wide, and the snowmobile leaped forward, puffing snow up behind it. In the caretaker's apartment, Jack Torrance's head jerked around at the high, wasp-like buzz of the approaching engine and suddenly began to move laboriously toward the hallway again. The bitch wasn't important now. The bitch could wait. Now it was this dirty nigger's turn. This dirty, interfering nigger with his nose in where it didn't belong. First him, and then his son. He would show them. He would show them that he was of managerial timber. Outside, the snowmobile rocketed along faster and faster. The hotel seemed to surge toward it. Snow flew in Halloran's face. The headlamp's oncoming glare spotlighted the hedge shepherd's face, its blank and socketless eyes. Then it shrank away, leaving an opening. Halloran yanked at the snowmobile's steering gear with all his remaining strength, and it kicked around in a sharp semicircle, throwing up clouds of snow, threatening to tip over. The rear end struck the foot of the porch steps and rebounded. Halloran was off in a flash and running up the steps. He stumbled, fell, picked himself up. The dog was growling, again in his head, close behind him. Something ripped at the shoulder of the parka, and then he was on the porch, standing in the narrow corridor Jack had shoveled through the snow, and safe. They were too big to fit in here. He reached the big double doors which gave on the lobby and dug for his keys again. While he was getting them, he tried the knob, and it turned freely. He pushed his way in.
"Danny?" he cried hoarsely. "Danny, where are you?"
Silence came back. His eyes traveled across the lobby to the foot of the wide stairs, and a harsh gasp escaped him. The rug was splashed and matted with blood. There was a scrap of pink terry cloth robe. The trail of blood led up the stairs. The banister was also splashed with it.
"Oh, Jesus,"
he muttered, and raised his voice again.
"Danny? Danny?"
The hotel's silence seemed to mock him with echoes which were almost there, sly and oblique.
Danny? Who's Danny? Anybody here know a Danny? Danny, Danny, who's got the Danny? Anybody for a game of spin the Danny? Pin the tail on the Danny? Get out of here, black boy. No one here knows Danny from Adam.
Jesus, had he come through everything just to be too late? Had it been done? He ran up the stairs two at a time and stood at the top of the first floor. The blood led down toward the caretaker's apartment. Horror crept softly into his veins and into his brain as he began to walk toward the short hall. The hedge animals had been bad, but this was worse. In his heart, he was already sure of what he was going to find when he got down there. He was in no hurry to see it. Jack had been hiding in the elevator when Halloran came up the stairs. Now, he crept up behind the figure in the snow-coated parka, a blood- and gore-streaked phantom with a smile upon its face. The roque mallet was lifted as high as the ugly, ripping pain in his back.
Did the bitch stick me? Can't remember, would allow. Black boy, he whispered. I'll teach you to go sticking your nose in other people's business.
Halloran heard the whisper and began to turn, to duck, and the roque mallet whistled down. The hood of the parka matted the blow, but not enough. A rocket exploded in his head, leaving a contrail of stars, and then nothing. He staggered against the silk wallpaper, and Jack hit him again, the roque mallet slicing sideways this time, shattering Halloran's cheekbone and most of the teeth on the left side of his jaw. He went down limply.
Now, Jack whispered. Now, by Christ!
Where was Danny? He had business with his trespassing son. 3 minutes later, the elevator door banged open on the shadowed third floor. Jack Torrance was in it alone. The car had stopped only halfway into the doorway, and he had to boost himself up onto the hall floor, wriggling painfully like a crippled thing. He dragged the splintered roque mallet after him. Outside the eaves, the wind howled and roared. Jack's eyes rolled wildly in their sockets. There was blood and confetti in his hair. His son was up here somewhere. He could feel it. Left to his own devices, he might do anything. Scribble on the expensive silk wallpaper with his crayons. Deface the furnishings. Break the windows. He was a liar and a cheat, and he would have to be chastised. Harshly. Jack Torrance struggled to his feet.
Danny?
He called.
Danny, come here a minute, will you? You've done something wrong, and I want you to come and take your medicine like a man. Danny? Danny!
54. Tony.
Danny. Danny.
Darkness and hallways. He was wandering through darkness and hallways that were like those which lay within the body of the hotel, but were somehow different. The silk-papered walls stretched up and up, and even when he craned his neck, Danny could not see the ceiling. It was lost in dimness. All the doors were locked, and they also rose up to dimness. Below the peepholes, in these giant doors, they were the size of gun sights. Tiny skulls and crossbones had been bolted to each door instead of room numbers. And somewhere, Tony was calling him.
Danny.
There was a pounding noise, one he knew well, and hoarse shouts, faint with distance. He could not make out word for word, but he knew the text well enough by now. He had heard it before, in dreams and awake. He paused, a little boy not yet 3 years out of diapers, and tried to decide where he was, where he might be. There was fear, but it was a fear he could live with. He had been afraid every day for 2 months now, to a degree that ranged from dull disquiet to outright mind-bending terror. This he could live with. But he wanted to know why Tony had come, why he was making the sound of his name in this hall that was neither a part of real things nor of the dreamland where Tony sometimes showed him things. Why? Where?
Danny.
Far down the giant hallway, almost as tiny as Danny himself, was a dark figure. Tony. Where am I? He called softly to Tony.
Sleeping, Tony said. Sleeping in your mommy and daddy's bedroom.
There was sadness in Tony's voice.
Danny, Tony said. Your mother is going to be badly hurt, perhaps killed. Mr. Halloran, too.
No! He cried it out in a distant grief, a terror that seemed damped by these dreamy, dreary surroundings. Nonetheless, death images came to him. Dead frog plastered to the turnpike like a grisly stamp. Daddy's broken watch lying on top of a box of junk to be thrown out. Gravestones with a dead person under every one. Dead Jay by the telephone pole. The cold junk Mommy scraped off the plates and down the dark maw of the garbage disposal. Yet he could not equate these simple symbols with the shifting, complex reality of his mother. She satisfied his childish definition of eternity. She had been when he was not. She would continue to be when he was not again. He could accept the possibility of his own death. He had dealt with that since the encounter in room 217. But not hers. Not Daddy's. Not ever. He began to struggle, and the darkness in the hallway began to waver. Tony's form became chimerical, indistinct.
Don't, Tony called. Don't, Danny. Don't do that.
She's not going to be dead. She's not.
Then you have to help her. Danny, you're in a place deep down in your own mind, the place where I am. I'm a part of you, Danny.
You're Tony. You're not me. I want my mommy. I want my mommy.
I didn't bring you here, Danny. You brought yourself. Because you knew.
No, you've always known, Tony continued, and he began to walk closer. For the first time, Tony began to walk closer.
You're deep down in yourself in a place where nothing comes through. We're alone here for a little while, Danny. This is an overlook where no one can ever come. No clocks work here. None of the keys fit them, and they can never be wound up. The doors have never been opened, and no one has ever stayed in the rooms. But you can't stay long. Because it's coming.
It, Danny whispered fearfully. And as he did so, the irregular pounding noise seemed to grow closer, louder. His terror, cool and distant a moment ago, became a more immediate thing. Now the words could be made out. Hoarse, huckstering. They were uttered in a coarse imitation of his father's voice, but it wasn't Daddy. He knew that now. He knew.
You brought yourself because you knew.
Oh, Tony, is it my daddy? Danny screamed. Is it my daddy that's coming to get me? Tony didn't answer, but Danny didn't need an answer. He knew. A long and nightmarish masquerade party went on here, and had gone on for years. Little by little a force had accrued, as secret and silent as interest in a bank account. Force, presence, shape. They were all only words, and none of them mattered. It wore many masks, but it was all one. Now somewhere it was coming for him. It was hiding behind Daddy's face. It was imitating Daddy's voice. It was wearing Daddy's clothes. But it was not his daddy. It was not his daddy.
I've got to help them, he cried.
And now Tony stood directly in front of him, and looking at Tony was like looking into a magic mirror and seeing himself in 10 years, the eyes widely spaced and very dark, the chin firm, the mouth handsomely molded. The hair was light blonde like his mother's, and yet the stamp on his features was that of his father, as if Tony, as if the Daniel Anthony Torrance that would someday be, was a halfling, caught between father and son, a ghost of both, a fusion.
You have to try to help, Tony said. But your father, he's with the hotel now, Danny. It's where he wants to be. It wants you, too, because it's very greedy.
Tony walked past him, into the shadows.
Wait, Danny cried. What can I— He's close now,
Tony said, still walking away.
You'll have to run. Hide. Keep away from him. Keep away.
Tony, I can't.
But you've already started,
Tony said.
You will remember what your father forgot.
He was gone. and from somewhere near his father's voice came, coldly wheedling. Danny?
You can come out, Doc.
Just a little spanking, that's all. Take it like a man, and it will be all over. We don't need her, Doc. Just you and me, right? When we get this little spanking behind us, it will be just you and me. Danny ran. Behind him, the thing's temper broke through the shambling charade of normality.
Come here, you little shit! Right now!
Down a long hall, panting and gasping, around a corner, up a flight of stairs, and as he went, the walls that had been so high and remote began to come down. The rug, which had only been a blur beneath his feet, took on the familiar black and blue pattern, sinuously woven together. The doors became numbered again, and behind them the parties that were all one went on and on, populated by generations of guests. The air seemed to be shimmering around him, the blows of the mallet against the walls echoing and re-echoing. He seemed to be bursting through some thin placental womb, from sleep to the rug outside the presidential suite on the third floor. Lying near him in a bloody heap were the bodies of two men dressed in suits and narrow ties. They had been taken out by shotgun blasts, and now they began to stir in front of him and get up. He drew in breath to scream, but didn't.
False faces, not real.
They faded before his gaze like old photographs and were gone. But below him, the faint sound of the mallet against the walls went on and on, drifting up through the elevator shaft and the stairwell. The controlling force of the overlook, in the shape of his father, blundering around on the first floor. A door opened with a thin, screeing sound behind him. A decayed woman in a rotten silk gown pranced out, her yellowed and splitting fingers dressed with verdigris-caked rings. Heavy-bodied wasps crawled sluggishly over her face.
"Come in,"
she whispered to him, grinning with black lips.
"Come in, and we will dance the tango."
"False face," he hissed. "Not real." She drew back from him in alarm, and in the act of drawing back, she faded and was gone.
"Where are you?"
it screamed, but the voice was still only in his head. He could still hear the thing that was wearing Jack's face down on the first floor. And something else. The high, whining sound of an approaching motor. Danny's breath stopped in his throat with a little gasp. Was it just another face of the hotel, another illusion? Or was it Dick? He wanted desperately to believe it was Dick, but he didn't dare take the chance. He retreated down the main corridor, and then took one of the offshoots, his feet whispering on the nap of the carpet. Locked doors frowned down at him as they had done in the dreams, the visions, only now he was in the world of real things, where the game was played for keeps. He turned to the right and came to a halt, his heart thudding heavily in his chest. Heat was blowing around his ankles. From the registers, of course. This must have been Daddy's day to heat the West Wing, and
"You will remember what your father forgot."
What was it? He almost knew. Something that might save him and Mommy? But Tony had said he would have to do it himself. What was it? He sank down against the wall, trying desperately to think. It was so hard. The hotel kept trying to get into his head. The image of that dark and slumped form, swinging the mallet from side to side, gouging the wallpaper, sending out puffs of plaster dust.
"Help me," he muttered. "Tony, help me."
And suddenly he became aware that the hotel had grown deathly silent. The whining sound of the motor had stopped. Must not have been real. And the sounds of the party had stopped, and there was only the wind, howling and whooping endlessly. The elevator whirred into sudden life. It was coming up. And Danny knew who, what, was in it. He bolted to his feet, eyes staring wildly. Panic clutched around his heart. Why had Tony sent him to the third floor? He was trapped up here. All the doors were locked. The attic. There was an attic, he knew. He had come up here with Daddy the day he had salted the rat traps around up there. He hadn't allowed Danny to come up with him because of the rats. He was afraid Danny might be bitten. But the trap door which led to the attic was set into the ceiling of the last short corridor in this wing. There was a pole leaning against the wall. Daddy had pushed the trapdoor open with the pole. There had been a ratcheting whir of counterweights as the door went up and a ladder had swung down. If he could get up there and pull the ladder after him. Somewhere in the maze of corridors behind him, the elevator came to a stop. There was a metallic, rattling crash as the gate was thrown back, and then a voice, not in his head now, but terribly real, called out, "Danny? Danny, come here a minute, will you? You've done something wrong, and I want you to come and take your medicine like a man. Danny? Danny!" Obedience was so strongly ingrained in him that he actually took two automatic steps toward the sound of that voice before stopping. His hands curled into fists at his sides.
"Not real. False face. I know what you are. Take off your mask."
"Danny!"
it roared.
"Come here, you pup. Come here and take it like a man."
A loud, hollow boom as the mallet struck the wall. When the voice roared out his name again, it had changed location. It had come closer. In the world of real things, the hunt was beginning. Danny ran. Feet silent on the heavy carpet, he ran past the closed doors, past the silk-figured wallpaper, past the fire extinguisher bolted to the corner of the wall. He hesitated, and then plunged down the final corridor. Nothing at the end but a bolted door, and nowhere left to run. But the pole was still there, still leaning against the wall where Daddy had left it. Danny snatched it up. He craned his neck to stare up at the trapdoor. There was a hook on the end of the pole, and you had to catch it on a ring set into the trapdoor. You had to... There was a brand new Yale padlock dangling from the trapdoor. The lock Jack Torrance had clipped around the hasp after laying his traps, just in case his son should take the notion into his head to go exploring up there someday. Locked. Terror swept him. Behind him, it was coming, blundering and staggering past the presidential suite, the mallet whistling viciously through the air. Danny backed up against the last closed door and waited for it. 55. That which was forgotten. Wendy came too, a little at a time. The grayness draining away, pain replacing it. Her back, her leg, her side. She didn't think she would be able to move. Even her fingers hurt, and at first she didn't know why. The razor blade, that's why. Her blonde hair, now dank and matted, hung in her eyes. She brushed it away, and her ribs stabbed inside, making her groan. Now she saw a field of blue and white mattress, spotted with blood. Her blood, or maybe Jack's. Either way, it was still fresh. She hadn't been out long, and that was important because... Why? Because... It was the insectile buzzing sound of the motor that she remembered first. For a moment she fixed stupidly on the memory, and then, in a single vertiginous and nauseating swoop, her mind seemed to pan back, showing her everything at once. Halloran. It must have been Halloran. Why else would Jack have left so suddenly, without finishing it? Without finishing her. Because he was no longer at leisure. He had to find Danny quickly and do it before Halloran could put a stop to it. Or had it happened already? She could hear the whine of the elevator rising up the shaft.
No, God, please no, the blood's still fresh, don't let it have happened already.
Somehow she was able to find her feet and stagger through the bedroom and across the ruins of the living room to the shattered front door. She pushed it open and made it out into the hall.
Danny?
She cried, wincing at the pain in her chest.
Mr. Halloran? Is anybody there? Anybody?
The elevator had been running again, and now it came to a stop. She heard the metallic crash of the gate being thrown back, and then thought she heard a speaking voice. It might have been her imagination. The wind was too loud to really be able to tell. Leaning against the wall, she made her way up to the corner of the short hallway. She was about to turn the corner when the scream froze her, floating down the stairwell and the elevator shaft.
Danny? Come here, you pup! Come here and take it like a man!
Jack, on the second or third floor, looking for Danny. She got around the corner, stumbled, almost fell, her breath caught in her throat. Something, someone, huddled against the wall about a quarter of the way down from the stairwell. She began to hurry faster, wincing every time her weight came down on her hurt leg. It was a man, she saw, and as she drew closer, she understood the meaning of that buzzing motor. It was Mr. Halloran. He had come after all. She eased to her knees.